Hey, everybody. I'm going to talk a little bit today about how we pretty much scaled Google's QA and repairs. And during this entire time, Google's fleet has been growing more than exponentially, so we were never able to do anything in a test environment. We had to do everything in a live production environment. So there was a lot of stuff involved with that that made sure that we didn't break everything. So I've been with Google 2003. I started off, I took a big jump down and decided to be a data center tech because I thought it'd be fun. Then I worked my way up through systems administration, and now I'm actually moving over to be a technical project manager. I led the teams that developed the QA and repairs machine managers and workflows, and I've done a lot of work with the data center techs and other groups at Google to help streamline the repairs and QA processes. And right now I'm working on a software qualification team, and I spend a lot of time with new platform introductions as well. So with this talk, we'll cover and we'll not cover, pretty easy. So I'm going to cover about the background of our QA and repairs infrastructure, talk about the design decisions that we made, tips and tricks that we did, how to approach design at a system design at a large scale, maybe some more stories. What we will not cover are numbers. So I'm not going to tell you how many machines we have, power usage, et cetera. I'm not going to get into specific hardware information. I'm not going to cover production machine management because that's out of my sandbox, and neither am I going to tell you how to game search algorithms. So hardware operations has been around for a very long time. It started off with, I think it was one data center tech back in 99, and then that grew to like two or three data center techs by 2000, 2001. We had a really small machine count. Repairs records were done on paper post-it notes, so you'd go up to a machine and you'd see a post-it note saying, Jimmy swapped this, swapped HDA last July. So that's how we kept track of repairs. Manual machine diagnoses, so you log in, scrape logs, just watch the post. All the repairs and QA processes were manual. So when I started, my mentor in the data center was like, okay, type in a for loop for M in backtick sequence 1 space 80. And I'm like, you know what, that's broken. I got to fix that. And we had no central data storage. So we had like six or seven different databases that, one database for repairs, one database for QA, another database for everything else. So that was the case up until late 2003. From 2003 to the present, we've had growth. I mean, everybody knows how big Google is. Well, it's insane. So machine count, the number of actual clusters, co-locations, the number of discrete hardware platforms, Intel and AMD that we use, the number of machine configurations. Before there were only two. Now there's multiple employees and campus cafes. Automation was, I think, the biggest thing that I helped bring to the table to help Google's growth. So AI1 is Auto Installer 1. The initial way that we used to do repairs was every machine that would come into repairs, the first thing we would do is reinstall it. And then we'd burn it in, and if it failed at any point, we'd go to a tech to work on. But AI1 was a collection of really crazy bash scripts and cron jobs, and it was not going to scale. AI2 is the current machine manager, and that is I helped develop that, led the team, and that's a big Python daemon that runs, uses many discrete phases per se, in install, in burn in, done burn in, straight to tech. So there's all these discrete steps that a machine can go through in the repairs process. So enters repairs, goes through the workflow, and at any point if it fails, it goes to what we call mock pool, which is what a data center tech can claim it as. This is all written in Python with a MySQL backend. QA master is the QA tool, which I wrote before AI2. That's the last Perl application, I think, actually developed at Google. I love Perl. But it's 3 years old, and Perl can be a write-only language, so it's kind of kludgy, and it's nowhere near the pristine state that it once was. We also got Touchpad going. Touchpad is a really cool application that runs on a laptop or a handheld. So when a data center tech is in the data center, and we've got a lot of machines, you want to know which one to work on. So you can claim machines to work on. You go up to them. It has a built-in scanner, so you can scan parts in and out. Really, you know, kind of nice. We've also had an exponential growth of our data center technicians and systems administrators. You know, hardware operations used to be 3 people. Now it's hundreds of people. Centralized data storage. That was, I think, the biggest win that we had, is getting all of those disparate databases all back together into one central data store. We are right now introducing automated machine diagnoses. It seems like this is something that we should have done a long time ago, but sometimes change is glacial. And then right now, the next generation repairs and QA machine managers and testing, which completely rewrites the database backend to the current repair system in QA. So here is pretty much how you work on machines at Google. This, I will tell you, is a little out of date and slightly inaccurate, but it's good enough for you know, our purposes here. So if you look in the upper left, you see machine assigned to repairs. It goes through auto installer. If there's no MAC address in the database, you reboot it, and then it goes to install. Then we burn in the machine. If it's a successful burn-in, we release. If it fails, we go to mock pool, which is in the middle upper. And mock pool is the general machine pool for broken machines. So that way you can claim them with the handhelds. We also do upgrades. This is old, so we used to do upgrades manually. Now Auto Installer 2 handles it. And yeah, that's pretty much how the repairs workflow works. Typically, like I said, you know, machine goes to repairs based on the symptom. If it's a bad DIMM or a bad hard drive pre-diagnosed, that gets sent straight to a data center technician to mock pool. Otherwise, we do the install and burn in. So how did we get from 3 data center techs to hundreds, no automation to full automation in 3 years without actually breaking anything? Well, so we basically had to figure out our goals. We had to scale the back-end services. We had to get machine management going and diagnoses tools. What did we have to do to get that done? We had to get a centralized, standardized data store. That was huge. You know, like I said, everything was done in a live environment, so careful testing and releases were very, very essential. I mean, when you're dealing with the amount of machines that we deal with, and you push a change out that handles how data center techs around the world do their jobs, you got to be pretty sure that that release is going to actually work. And honestly, sometimes they didn't, but most times they did. Streamlining processes. I mean, we're talking about, you know, how long does a machine stay in install? How long does a machine stay in burn-in? What's the associated cost of that? And also, how can we make it better? So when a data center tech walks up to a machine, that machine needs to be in a state where he can log in and do work on it and swap parts and scan. So you have to sit down and just like literally map out all the little step-by-step, you know, minutiae it takes to fix a machine. Another thing is also leaving a lot of areas open-ended. So that way you can get data center techs who are actually on the floor doing the work to help contribute tools and various parts of the process. If we, you know, because in Mountain View, we don't have there's no data centers around the campus. So we're not going to be able to be like, oh, okay, here's how exactly this is going to have to work. So it's hard for our team to lay down the law, because if we do that, there's going to be, you know, hundreds of people saying, well, we do things slightly differently. So we have to leave the processes open-ended enough to take into account that, and also to absorb, say, new tools that come in from the field. So this is how we grew the tools and processes. Initially, we didn't do any math. No statistical analysis. Nobody sat down and said, burn-in takes X number of hours, install takes X number of hours, you know, machines sit in a pool for this amount of time. So all of the streamlining we did was based on anecdotal evidence, you know, and obvious problems. So burn-in was taking multiple days, so we decided to shorten burn-in. So we did some testing to make sure that it caught the same amount of errors or similar amount of errors, and then we shortened burn-in. We made some choices to lock down the high-level processes. So this means that machine management workflows, that was all designed and implemented and locked down through, you know, the Mountain View area. But we left a lot of stuff open for floor-level interactions. So that way, if, let's say, a data center tech in Virginia came up with a better idea on how to diagnose machines and wrote a tool for it, that would not interfere with the machine workflows. So that way, when a machine is given to a tech, they're pretty much free to do whatever they want with it at that point. And the worst thing is that HWAPS started off as a black box to the rest of the company. This meant that we designed most of our tools and processes in a vacuum. So nobody cared about how their machines came back or how their machines were released to production. And we were, you know, that's why QA Master, the first tool I wrote at Google, was in Perl. I didn't realize that we were a Python shop because engineering did not talk to operations much at the time. That has been changing drastically, and now we use lots and lots and lots of common libraries amongst the entire production fleet. Constant vigilance. It's really, really hard to understand that sometimes a very small change can have incredibly, unintended consequences. For instance, changing how a field in the database is formatted, because let's say 90% of the people using that field know that change is happening, but only 10% don't, but that 10% has a larger application with more impact. So you have to be very, very careful and just due diligence, make sure everyone knows that changes are happening, make sure that everything is tested, and even then, there's still a lot of times there's not enough communication. A lot of tools that we use now were discovered and enveloped into the HWAPS code base. There's this one great tool called BrainSpawn that we use that tracks machine history. So a machine enters repairs, and you're wondering, well, how many times has it been in repair? What steps were taken with it? When was it previously in repair? Has it come back 15,000 times? So you just go to this web page and type in machine names, and after about a 2-minute wait for the database lookups, you have these gigantic lists of machine repair history. And that was written by David Knowles on the far end down there. So he was a data center tech, and there was a need for a tool. Our group didn't have enough people, so we found out about BrainSpawn, enveloped it, and now he's a member of the sysadmin team. It's actually a pretty good system. All of our projects, we only have, I think, 6 people left in Mountain View in my team, and there's 30, 40, like 40 or so people in my group. They are all scattered around the world, so every time we do projects, we have to work with people all over the place. And this actually works out for the best, because it means that we can do project handoffs. I gave up QA Master 2.5 years ago, and people in Atlanta handle it now. Auto Installer 2, AI 2, my project after that, has already gone through 2 handoffs. And Jeff Gibson right here, he is the current maintainer and manager of it. And the fact that, you can write a lot of code and you have a big, huge project and then work with other people remotely, and when it's time for you to move on to something else, you can easily just hand it off and it's flawless. And general, employee growth. I mean, the more people you get, the more brains you get, the more ideas you get. Sometimes it's, really, really, really hard to come up with, think of every possible solution. But if you have 10 other people, working with you on it, then you can cover a lot more bases. So another big thing I want to talk about is code maintainability. This, I think, is something that a lot of people don't pay enough attention to. You have to standardize everything. We're talking style, variable naming, the actual languages used. And this way, more than one person can actually go in and work on code. So if I take up, if I need to do a change list on, say, AI2, the current machine workflow manager, it doesn't matter that I haven't touched the code in a year, because due to standardized coding guides, I can go in and look at the code and immediately know what is going on there. And this goes for anybody. So it's an incredibly important thing to do. And it's something that I cannot stress enough, is one-off solutions that, are quick hacks are probably more dangerous in the long run than anyone would imagine. Because I can guarantee a lot of you out there in the audience have started a job somewhere and found out about a little script that runs to take care of something that breaks, and you go and you look at it, and you have absolutely no idea what it does, and it takes you a lot of extra time to reverse engineer it, figure out the processes, what's going on with it. Instead, if you have standardized coding, you can just look at the code, and if everything is, you know, like a centralized data store, you know where the data is going to be stored, you know the code format, and it's really easy to read. It's, you know, it's brainless at that point. Another thing is flexibility. So you got to lock down the processes at the top. You know, machines go through certain phases. They go through certain steps in a process. That is, you know, you kind of have to lock that down. This way you can get statistics, you can track machines, you know what happens at all times. At the same time, you know, they has to be really extensible. So if you need to add more to the process, it can be really easy. And the way that AutoInstaller 2 does it is that we have, it's all object-driven. Each phase is its own object. You can do two things. If you just want to put a blank phase that doesn't do anything, you just insert it into the phases table in the database. And then AutoInstaller 2 will just be like, you know, A, B, C, D. It'll automatically pick up the new phase. It just doesn't happen to do anything. And if you want to do something, you just throw in the phase.py in the phases directory and recompile. And it's, you know, works great. The flexibility is a very, very important thing to do when you're talking about trying to scale in a live environment. Because you never know, like I was saying earlier, you can never cover all your bases initially. So you have to be sure that anything you engineer has the flexibility to be, you know, extended as needed. And then monolithic systems. Sometimes good, sometimes bad, always complex. When you have one tool that manages all the machines and repairs, you know, at least it's one source, but at the same time, it's going to be really complex. Databases, you know, case in point, when you have one huge central database to store all the machine state, machine names, all the data that you can have about a machine, it's great because it's all in one place. Same time, knowing the nuances and intricacies of where the data lives, what tables, what joins you need to do for SQL, you know, that is just, it gets really complex. So it's a complete trade-off. I can't talk enough about planning. You got to sit down, write design documents, review them, make sure you get a lot of visibility. Because you can never, and I'll keep saying this, but you can never cover all your bases initially. You think you can, but there's always going to be something on the side that you completely forgot about. Or somebody will spring something, you know, there's a process already in place that covers half of what you're doing that you didn't know about. So the more visibility you get to your plans, the better your final product is going to be. And this is another great way of making sure that it's an open-ended process as well. You know, accepting that sometimes the solution at hand is not the best, but it's good enough. We knew for years that burn-in on our machines wasn't the best way to test machines coming out of repairs, but it was good enough. It found hard drive errors, memory errors, you know, tested the machines, stressed all the subsystems, I/O, but it definitely was not the best tool. This one is really kind of hard to swallow sometimes because, you know, trying to be a perfectionist is a noble goal. At the same time, not always achievable. And then the last point here, engineering in a live environment, it's like base jumping. You know, you just kind of close your eyes, run forward, and jump, hoping that you don't hit that little rock outcropping about 200 feet down, kind of ruin your day. You know, pushing out, hitting the big red button is sometimes the scariest thing that you can do. And if you take into account everything I was talking about previously, you know, planning, accepting solutions that you know will work but may not be the best, all the visibility, you know, standardized coding, code reviews, all that kind of stuff, that's all the things you need to take care of before you push that big red button. Another thing we do is gradual releases. So AI1, AutoInstaller 1, the old Bash cron job-based machine manager, was running simultaneously with AI2, the Python daemon with full database connections, they were running side by side for about a year. And as we would introduce new phases for AI 2, as we continually develop the code, we would gradually roll back what AI 1 was doing. It worked out really well. And something that I'm always going to try and do from now on is if I need to replace a system, make sure that both systems can run simultaneously. You can do this via making sure that you use new database tables to store state, this also ensures that any data changes you make for a machine, that they're the same for both applications. We're talking about... It's basically just learning how to roll out new processes while rolling back old ones is incredibly important, and it makes the last bit that I'm talking about, the live environment, it makes it so much easier to release. This way, if you break something, you have an immediate way to roll back and have something to take its place. Another thing is choosing your technologies carefully. Python versus Perl versus Ruby, MySQL versus Oracle, XML versus YAML, especially in a large environment like Google, you need the code to be readable, you need it to be reliable. You need new people to be able to come on board and pick up right away the technologies. So we're a couple steps behind the curve when it comes to, using Python. We don't use the latest and greatest version. Maybe it has all these neat features that we want, but there's an incredible amount of code already out there that won't take advantage of it, doesn't take advantage of it, and might even need to be ported. So you gotta, make that decision. It's why we don't use Perl. I've been coding Perl for a long time, and I fully admit that it is not the best solution for a large organization, especially for operations code. It gives you a lot of strengths, a lot of flexibility. The regular expressions are fantastic, but it's really messy to read. And one of the great things about Perl is you can do one thing in 10,000 ways. But if you lock down the code and the style guides and et cetera, having one way to do one thing is a lot better. That's why we chose Python versus Perl, because Python isn't as flexible as Perl, but it's still very powerful. It's why we don't use Ruby either. Ruby is, I'm gonna call it a newer technology, it's a newer language. But at the same time, more people know Python, and Python is, definitely, I think, easier to read than Ruby. And use it, consistently. Don't say, oh, well, maybe I'll use XSLT for this one XML transformation and then never use XSLT again. That means whomever inherits your next project will have absolutely no idea what it does. And I hate XSLT. Databases. Sleeping with the enemy. We're talking about centralized data stores. When you have one place to keep all your data, you gotta be sure that all the table names are standardized, data formats are standardized. You're never gonna get everyone to agree on one thing, but you gotta come up with a good enough design and a good enough solution so that finding the data, for new people coming in trying to look through the database tables, it needs to have a logical naming scheme. This way, you don't have, one of the problems we have right now is there are three naming schemes for tables in the database. There's camel case, there's the underscore, and then there's the beginning cap camel case. So joining tables sometimes, you have to literally understand I'm in this part of the database, so it's all named this way. It's ridiculous. Make sure that, the databases are backed up. Make sure that all the data is fresh and up to date. Be very careful about what data you put in the database. Do you want to store software information in the database? For instance, what BIOS release on this one platform is in there, what the most current version of Burn-in is, or stuff like that. Or do you want to restrict the database to just, hard machine information? That's a really, really tough choice to make, because once you put something in the database and you start using it, you better be damn sure that that data is going to be updated and fresh. So if you have this great application and you're like, oh, I'll store all this data in the database, there's a good chance if no one uses it that that data is going to get stale. And if people rely on it, it's going to be completely useless. Another thing is automation. I cannot stress this enough. Automate everything. You know, you're not going to automate yourself out of work because that's impossible. But the more you automate, the less work you have to do. The easier it is for just you to push the big red button and just watch the magic. Workflows are incredibly important for automation. So figuring out the steps that you have to take to get a process done. For example, queuing a machine. There's discrete steps. So lay them out in a block diagram, and then you have your phases, you have your states. You know exactly what needs to happen for at each step of the way. Statistical analysis is indeed your friend. Figure out what exactly is going on at any point with the machine in repairs. Knowing how long a machine is going to last in a certain area. Time is money. So when you have a nice discrete workflow and you have a very, very, very good idea of how long each step takes, then you can fine tune it. You can easily identify where machines are lagging, where they're sitting, where money is being lost. If you just do it anecdotally, you're never going to find this information. And the biggest lesson that we've learned from, you know, all of this live development, all this live deployment, you know, no testing, no beta, well, lots of testing, but be careful. Like, know exactly what the consequences of a release are. If you're going to be changing, you know, the back end to, if you're going to be changing the database, you have to know that whoever accesses that table is going to have to be aware of those data changes. If you're changing a workflow manager, you better be sure that all the people out there working on the machines know that the workflow is changing. Have a very good exit routes. So this way, if you roll something out that breaks the world, you can just push a button and have it roll back, and everything will be hopefully fixed. You'd be very, very careful with writes. If someone is able to modify the database, modify certain tables, and they make a mistake, you know, we had people close every repairs case at Google a couple of years ago by accident. So all of a sudden, the repairs count was really nice. It was zero. Granted, those machines were all broken. Some were even burning in at the time, you know, but they were all back out in production. The best repairs count we've ever had. So having that, you know, having that ability to change those states, very dangerous, very powerful. So you got to be careful. And that's about it. Now, Av is going to talk about release engineering. So before Av came on board, release engineering basically entailed of, I think we're ready for a release, guys?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, okay, sounds great, enter. And, whoa, is that me? Okay. So that was really bad. One of my favorite war story is the guy who developed Touchpad. The second guy to work on Touchpad. He ported it from PHP to Python. He lived about an hour away from Mountain View, did not have a cell phone, and did not have a phone at home. So he would release Touchpad and then go home. So he'd be on the bus for like an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, whatever, you know, it's nighttime in Mountain View, so he'd go to sleep. And I remember 1 week I was on call. Ireland gets to work around 11 p.m. West Coast time. Around 3 a.m., I started getting paged. And it turns out that there was a bad Touchpad release. It was a black box to me. I had no idea what was going on. The techs in Ireland were rebooting the Touchpad server as I was on it trying to debug it. I'm calling Evan. Turns out, you know, this number has been disconnected. And the entire time, he had no idea that this was going on until the next morning when I hadn't gotten any sleep and he sits next to me and I kind of gave him a look. He got a cell phone soon after that. So this is pre-release engineering.
Cool. Everyone hear me? Technical wardrobe malfunction.
Yeah. Trust me, we're professionals.
Great. So thanks, Shane. As he mentioned, release engineering at Google is done differently by different departments. And when I started, we had no release engineering in hardware operations. And this was one of the first projects that I worked on. We basically had grown to such a large organization and a worldwide organization that we really needed to implement some kind of process. So this is sort of release engineering 101. How we came up with the processes that we thought worked best, and hopefully, you know, other people can take from this and go from there. A lot of this is based on the ITIL framework, which some of you may be familiar with. I know a lot of people I speak to about ITIL are very sort of weary of it and don't like, oh my God, you know, this is not a good thing, and it's all this red tape and bureaucracy, and it really doesn't have to be that. I think release engineering can be, you know, something that really adds a lot of benefit without taking away very much of the positive aspects of sort of the develop and release cycle. So. All right, so as Sanjay mentioned earlier, I've been at Google since 2005. I came from Earthlink before then, working as a systems administrator. Skip over that. Okay. So why is release engineering important? It reduces the number of problems that are seen by your customers, and ultimately, as systems administrators, I think our goal is to make sure our customers are as happy as they can be, whether they're, you know, internal customers, you know, in our company, or whether it's, you know, paying customers from the outside. Our job is to basically make sure that the softwares or applications or services that they use stay up as much as possible. So, you know, release engineering should really be a critical component of any system administrator's sort of tool belt. Technology's not going to like me today. I'm just going to close this right here. Okay. Please be nice. It can better provide a definition to roles in a systems administrators group. As Shane mentioned, we went from, what, 2-3 systems administrators to over 50 in our group now. And all of us have different roles. Some of us lean towards writing tools and scripts and developing, and others of us lean towards, you know, sort of troubleshooting, fixing problems. And having release engineering in that process can really help define who does what and who's good at what, so that in the event that you have problems or you need to find people, you can you know who to turn to. And we'll talk more about that later. It can help improve communication inside your group. And that's one thing people don't really think about very much when they think about release engineering, but a major aspect of it is improving communication, both internally and externally. And let's face it, you know, none of us are, as geeks, we're not really good at communicating. So it helps us a lot. Okay. Okay, so these are sort of some prerequisites that we came up for releasing software. We decided that all of our software had to have deployment instructions so that anyone could come in, take software, and know which machines it goes on, how to get it there, how to turn it on, and maintain it. That ties in very closely with having backout instructions. It's really bad to be the person on call the night after something critical has been pushed out and not know how to roll it back to a previous version, or you know, or knowing why it broke, or even in the first place, knowing that something was rolled out. So having backout instructions as part of deploying your software can be really, really vital. And of course, then, you know, sort of tying in pre-deploy and post-deploy testing, having unit tests, service tests, regression tests comes in there. End user readable release notes. Again, this is, you know, part of the communication. A lot of systems administrators, you know, don't think about when they're writing software or releasing software, they don't think about really writing release notes that end users can read and understand what is happening. And it's really beneficial for even people who aren't very technical to know what's going on. It brings a lot of sort of awareness to what we do and how it impacts them, so they can sort of appreciate our jobs a little more. Next, we decided to divide up all of our software. We decided to make three categories. Critical software, which was sort of designed as being mission critical or having a very large business impact. For example, Touchpad is one of these that Shane talked about, is one of these applications. When it goes down, our techs have a very hard time. Well, they actually can't repair any of the machines. So, you know, the whole process will grind to a halt if Touchpad is broken. And that used to happen on several occasions before we brought in release engineering and defined all the things that Touchpad needs to be able to do before it can actually go into our production environment. So that became critical software. But we try and really limit what we consider critical, because if you consider everything critical, then it takes forever trying to get, you know, any new software out there. So most stuff generally falls into what we consider important. And important is always important to somebody, right? I think, you know, some of the tools that I write are pretty important. If they don't work, then, well, you know, maybe 10% of the people can't do their work. But that's, it's still pretty important. And the rest, there's always, you know, little pieces of tools and things that go out there, and we still care about them, and they're still important, and, you know, but if they break, well, not many people are going to notice, but we still want some kind of release engineering around those. We still want the whole, you know, instructions on how to deploy, how to back out, how to test it, so that, again, anyone can do it. You don't want to be the guy on call when everything breaks. Approval mechanisms. You want some kind of approval mechanisms for when you do releases. And whether that's, you know, five guys sitting around a table, you know, over lunch deciding, okay, well, this is sort of ready, okay, we'll push this out tonight and, you know, we'll wait for the other stuff until tomorrow night. Or whether it's, you know, full change control boards with people from different organizations in your company coming together and figuring out which deploys impact different people in what ways and whether they overlap with work going on in other departments. You definitely want some kind of approval mechanism. And we'll talk in a few moments about release schedules and how they play into this. So organization distribution can often dictate how many people need to be notified of changes. If you have a small group of system administrators that are responsible for maintaining software that's used by HR, finance, you know, legal, whatever, then you have to have a notification method that, you know, all of these people can use. And sometimes you have to get creative with methods you use. You may want to, you know, go up to people's whiteboards and start writing on them, hey, you're going to have new software tonight. If it breaks, call us. Bye. Maybe create a blog internally that people can get an RSS feed from. Use group calendars. You know, Google Calendar is a really nice tool. But, you know, have different things that people can use. And different people may want information differently, and your process should be able to accept this. And when you're trying to release a piece of software, you should know, hey, this is going out to some developers who log into these machines. Maybe I can put something in the message of the day for these machines so that when they log in, they'll know, hey, this has changed, and I know who to contact and who to talk to. It's very frustrating for people, and I've been on the, you know, most of us, I'm sure, have been on the other end of this, when somebody releases new software and you don't know what's changed, or you may not even know that something was changed, and just starting to see subtle differences in how you used to do your work before, and wait, this key combination doesn't work anymore, or this command doesn't exist, or this help, you know, this switch on this command is different now, what's going on? Knowing why those changes were made, who made those changes, who to turn to, is really, really invaluable. And again, you know, tying back into when you classify your software, whether you think it's critical, important, you can decide with, you know, the groups that are impacted how much notification they want. You know, for me, if I was just working on my own little network, I wouldn't give anybody notification. I know what I'm doing. But if I was releasing software that would affect my entire department, I may want to, you know, just at least stand up in the queue and shout, hey, I'm releasing some new software. Maybe that's enough. If it's really critical, maybe it needs a little more notification than that. You know, maybe it needs 24 hours of notification so that people, maybe if they're working on certain libraries and you're going to upgrade the operating system on a development machine, they know that there may be some issues with this and they can, you know, maybe get to a point where they can save their work and again, you know, that notification, I've seen it go up to as much as 7 days, and probably in some places it's more than 7 days. This is really critical so that other people can know what you're working on, you know, and they can know that something's about to impact them pretty heavily in the case of critical software. Important software obviously needs a little bit less notification, still needs notification. Maybe it's not really that important, and you can send out a message after you're done or as you're about to start, and then the rest of the stuff doesn't really need very much notification, but that's up to you. Maybe you find that, you know, you really want some notification. The key thing here is, you know, at least get the information out there so that other people can know what's going on. And releasing notification has to go the other way, too. You want to tell people when things are done successfully. Otherwise, how do they know? They can guess. They can assume. Maybe they're smart enough to go look up versions of installed packages. Maybe they're not. It's important to let people know when they're done. Are postmortems needed? Postmortems are a pretty common tool in, you know, for most sysadmins that I've met. They use them when things go wrong. Are they useful other times? Sure they are. Maybe you want to have a postmortem every time something's released. You have a standard format that everyone can read and say, okay, I know what happened here and I can look for problems. I can see how they were solved. And it's a great way to communicate, you know, interesting changes you found when you had to put out a new piece of software that the other people on your team can be aware of. Separation of responsibility. Developers will always want to develop, and they will never like release engineering. It's just the way it is. They will want to develop, push it out, develop, push it out, develop, push it out. It's just the way they work. And you can't fault them for it. It's great. But you really have to not let them push out software. Most small companies I've worked at, you know, developers have root on all the production systems, and they take care of, you know, writing the new software, updating things, and then rolling it out, and everyone can see it. And it's not always bad in small companies, but as you grow, when you start to want release engineering, you really want to start separating these responsibilities. It's the duty of sysadmins to really make sure that these customers that they're, you know, that are either paying or internal or whoever they are happy. And if developers sort of have free roam on production systems, that can often lead to bad things happening. So have that clear distinction there. Deployment timetables, define what days are off limits. As Shane mentioned, you know, as you mentioned, you know, doing things at times when there's going to be fewer people around to solve problems is bad. So maybe write off Fridays and weekends for doing deploys. Talk to other groups. You know, if you are a sysadmin group and there's another sysadmin group in the company that have slightly overlapping responsibilities, talk to each other. Make sure that when you're going to be deploying something on a certain day, it's not going to conflict with some of their scheduling. And holiday moratoriums are great because it gives us a break. Around the end of the year, around Thanksgiving, there's usually fewer people around to do maintenance work. So you really want to be careful what you deploy. Anyone who's working around that time of the year, they probably don't want to have to sit around not doing very much. And it's slightly worse than at other times of the year because it may take them a lot longer to find the right people to come fix, their broken software. So maybe you want to define, periods of the year when you don't deploy any software. Lessons learned. As I mentioned, developers will always want to develop. A lot of them will have sort of a negative bias towards release engineering because it really slows down their work. And it doesn't have to if it's done right. They can continue to develop and iterate over their changes. And your job should be to obsess over red tape. Everyone hates it. It's really, really bad. And I speak to a lot of people who have had really bad experiences with release engineering because it introduced artificial limitations. For example, let's slow down how we do releases. Releases can only happen once a week. Why? Well, we think it's good because you don't want releases to happen too often. Why not? Because it's bad, because things break. Well, they don't have to. Having artificial red tape in the way it's really unnecessary in many cases. Sure, there are sometimes legitimate reasons why you do want that in the way. But more often than not, you really don't need it. And if the whole purpose of release engineering is to stop things breaking and provide good communication, I think it can be done without very much red tape at all. And ties in very closely to the final point there, which is that flexibility is much more important than a rigid procedure. There will always be exceptions to the rule. Maybe you have an emergency release of your software. If you write in that, there is no way we will ever do releases on a Friday, but everything's going to be broken for the entire weekend, well, you should be able to do releases on a Friday to fix, very broken things. Some people don't like that. Some people say, no, leave it broken over the weekend. No. Turns out sometimes flexibility is much more important than rigid procedure. Short talk.
Hello. Thanks a lot, Shane and Evelyn. So we have plenty of time for questions. When you come, please come to the mic. And I have a mic here. If you are welcome to borrow this, and there is a mic out there at the back.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yep.
I've been hoping Google would speak out on practical issues of maintaining a production environment for a long time. So I do have a list of questions. If I ask anything that you wouldn't feel comfortable answering, I understand what it's like to work for a company that's a big target. So I understand if you defer. Is your team responsible for deploying internal software as well as production software?
It's all internal. Our customers are, so we're in the group called Hardware Systems. We mm-hmm. support hardware operations, which is the data center techs like out in the field.
Mm-hmm. And the release engineering process, this rigor you have is only applied for the work your team does? It's your own process for internal release?
It's sort of a mixture. It applies strongly to a lot of the work that we do. But there are also other teams that want to deploy software internally. For example, we have we have groups that give us software to put on machines that people in the field can use. So these processes affect them as well. So we work very closely with those people and make sure that when we do our release engineering, that it doesn't affect them too negatively either.
And can you mentioned the need for a change some kind of change control review, whether it's something as formal as a change control board or just everybody getting together at lunch, which I hear is free at Google. Where are you guys in that continuum? Do you have a formal change control team with members from around the company? Or?
Well, we just actually went through a small change in our team, so the structure is fluctuating a little bit. But we had a group of people. There wasn't a formal change control board because we didn't feel it was necessary for our group. Our group, while it's 50 people, is not a small number. It's not large enough that we need a huge formal meeting once a week. There are other groups inside Google that do that, but it isn't necessary for our process. We simply had a method where people could request a software version be deployed and have it ready for us along with the instructions on how to do it. And then we would either approve it or deny it. And denying was very, very rare. We worked very closely with developers to make sure that their development instructions were accurate, that if we had any questions, they could be resolved before it came time to actually make a decision.
You mentioned your burn-in process several times. Could you describe that for us?
Yes. Basically, it's a series of tests that we run on machines. We stress the hard drives, the RAM, CPU, floating point, basically a typical a large series of machine tests that put the machine at about 100%. Then after the tests are run, there's some processes in part of the burn-in package that parse the logs given, spewed out by, say, the memory tester and the disk tester. We also scrape var log messages for other errors, stuff like that.
Shane, you mentioned workflows in your presentation. I'm curious what format and how you execute and archive those.
What format? I'm not sure.
Are these program workflows or are these documentation workflows that you were referring to?
They're programmatical workflows. So, for instance, AI2, every phase has an entry, an exit, and a failure. So if at any point during the process a machine fails a phase transition, that usually means the machine is broken and it goes right into the pool for text to work on. And all those phases are stored in the database with good names describing exactly what they do.
So do you write your own unit tests and regression tests, or do you work closely with the developers in this?
Combination of both.
Hi. You had discussed the idea of the phases and such like being very open and extensible so that you can have a lot of people providing their input and everything, but it seems to me that the machine states or phases that you're wanting to represent in your database, wouldn't you want to keep that relatively constrained, and has that led to any complexity in terms of things kind of expanding beyond what you'd originally intended?
Yes. Fully. best laid plans of mice and men, you go into something with the best intentions and, I'm going to lock down this and then leave the rest of it open, but at the same time, as time goes on, more and more phases pop up, and it just turns into a beast. AI2, the scope of AI2 is just a lot bigger than it was, say, 2 years ago. Yeah, he asked if we've taken any steps to rectify it. Yes, we're getting rid of AI2. Yeah, we're basically the next generation machine manager is in beta right now in a couple of clusters, and that is... actually, something I meant to talk about, I can talk about this really fast, is when I moved on to, I initially started off in the QA group, which is why I wrote QA Master. Then I went to the repairs team, and I was tasked with rewriting Auto Installer. So I looked at the current database, all the transitions and whatnot in the cases, and I found it to be incredibly complex, and I thought it was pretty stupid. So I decided to put my own layer on top of that, which was, I thought, a good solution at the time. Looking back, I should have rewritten everything, and that is what's actually happening right now, is a much simpler system is going into place.
I was wondering if you could talk briefly about your hardware failure rates. I would expect hard drives to go out before anything else, but what else have you seen?
Yeah, there was a document published by Wolf Weber and a couple other people last year about hard drive failure rates.
Mm-hmm.
I can't give you guys any numbers on our that.
Well, not numbers, but just like a ranking of like after hard drives, what do you generally see?
Hard drives, RAM. RAM is a big one. Barely any motherboards, barely any power supplies, a lot of bad Ethernet cable.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the interests of disclosure, I work for Google, but this is not a planted question. fleet availability, how many machines that we own are actually available, running? What's left? How can we improve that? What's the low-hanging fruit, if any? Or if there is none, what made the biggest difference in having machines not sitting idle and broken?
Excellent question. One of the first things we did, and you guys can feel free to jump in if you want, turn that on. But to minimize downtime, you know, we looked at the life of a machine in repairs. You know, how long does it spend in install, in burn-in? How long do these machines sit in the mock pool waiting for a data center tech to claim them to fix them? And it turns out that a lot of machines were sitting there, well, a small number of machines were sitting for an inordinate amount of time. Due to the fact that there are literally machines that just want to break. They've had every single part swapped on them. It is a brand new machine, and they always continually fail. Then we investigate stuff like vibrational issues, environmental issues. We had an issue where solar flares popped up, and a bunch of memory errors started happening, and a whole bunch of machines went to repairs, you know. So,
yeah. So I mean, in terms of low-hanging fruit, recidivism, like how many machines go out of repairs and then very quickly come back into repairs with the same problem is definitely a low-hanging fruit that we work against.
So right now, is it what, three times it comes in, and we mark it as recidivist?
Yeah.
So if a machine has, let's say, bad HDC, and it comes in three times with bad HDC, it is marked as a recidivist machine and sent to the mock pool for a tech to look at, because that means that you have to look deeper. Maybe it's a bad cable, bad controller card, you know, anything, bad power supply. You know, if your rails are too low, you're going to get problems. Another thing is we have recalcitrant machines, which is kind of what I was describing earlier, machines that no matter what, they just always want to break. Those we usually take them out back, but, you know.
It's interesting that you never mentioned configuration management, and I was wondering, is your installer a configuration management tool? Is it just strictly an installer? Is that somebody else's department that does configuration management, or do you just install and leave machines up forever? Or what?
Configuration management, yeah. We basically get the system image from another group and pop it on our installers, and magic. Sorry? That's the end of it, yeah.
So I was a little surprised that you mentioned hardly any power supply failures. Can you disclose, are you using AC or DC power supplies generally?
We use steam power. No, no, it's regular data center power.
Just AC. Regular AC
yeah.
power?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
You mentioned about the need to keep rigorous statistics on failures. Are you successful at Google in creating the feedback loop for future purchase decisions? That's where many companies fall apart, is the sysadmins almost never get the level of input needed into the next generation of purchase decisions based on previous experience.
Yes, we have a direct line with our builds group that talks of purchasing. So. It actually works out pretty well. We know immediately if we get a bad batch of RAM. I mean, if you know X number of machines fail the MEM test in say an upgrade or during QA, we have set ways to communicate that back up the food chain and get to the manufacturers.
And do you have techniques you can share for when you need to do fleet-wide upgrades, whether it's a sweeping OS patch or hardware replacement? How do you manage that?
That is beyond the, well, some of that is beyond the scope of what my team or my group does. So for instance, software upgrades are usually handled by the people that manage the actual machines in the production fleet. When it comes to hardware upgrades, a request is put in for this batch of machines to be upgraded, and then there's a workflow.
I was just going to mention that that's another reason to really make sure you lock down high-level processes, but make sure that the techs on the floor have the liberty to do things the way that they want. There's a big difference in the way that techs in Virginia do upgrades, and there's a big difference in the way techs in Chicago do upgrades. And some things work better for them, and some things work better for us. So it's really important to keep those processes open and make sure that you're communicating with the techs on the floor, since they're your main customers as system administrators.
Anyone else?
Yeah, so you mentioned that when you are redeploying a machine, you have to be extremely careful to know which services or which users are dependent on that machine. This seems to me like a pretty hard, arbitrarily complex problem, so, right?
No, it's actually quite simple.
Yeah.
You know which users use machines. For example, we know which machines Gmail runs on. So when we need to work on those machines, we just let those people know. We just keep a record of who has things running on those machines. And when something goes wrong with those machines or we need to work on those machines, then we can quite simply let those people know.
Yep, it's all in the database.
Well, wait, is a machine maybe acting as a router, for example? So if you take it away, then you have to know whether the end-to-end endpoints are still reachable through other routers, right? And that, it's not a question of keeping tracks of users there, it's a question of knowing what the topology of the routing is.
So I think I sort of understand what you're saying. You're basically saying, what if there's, you know, a separate component that, you know, doesn't directly have a mapping for who it affects? And I'm actually going to answer that by saying I don't actually think we have anything like that.
No, I don't think
we just
do.
We're very, very diligent about, you know, making sure we know exactly who is affected by what. For example, we know exactly who is affected if a particular data center goes down. We know that because we know which groups are assigned which sets of machines. So based on that, when anything goes wrong with that data center, we can actually trace the network paths and say, okay, we know because this switch went down, you know, this set of racks was affected. Therefore, these people need to be, you know, they should have been informed that there was a problem.
Yeah. And the monitoring that they use in production on all the services and the traffic routing blows me away. So if a data center falls off the face of the earth, it, you know, will cause some panic, but
it's very short-term.
Very short-term panic, and there are ways to reroute traffic and reroute services. So the same thing, if you have an entire batch of machines that, let's say a bad kernel gets pushed out and you have thousands of machines crashing, those services can always easily be rerouted. When you have as many machines as we do, the pain point is a lot higher. You know, you can afford to lose a number of machines and usually be okay.
Right, so it's been carefully designed to prevent single points of failure then?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I was trying to think of how to voice this question and not get into the territory you're not going to address. I mean, Google's been around long enough and you've had enough large infrastructure long enough that kind of decommissioning servers. You know, you can have a situation where some companies will go and drive a server until it's absolutely dead. The manufacturers end-of-lifed it, you can't get support on it, still they want to go for it. Others, depreciable lifespan's over, it's done. For something that's 4 or 5 years old, in this day and age with power concerns, it's not worth keeping on the floor because you can put something new that's going to give you, you know, 3, 4, or 5 times the processing power for the same amount of juice. So can you kind of a talk to how you handle that, since obviously your electricity bill has got to be huge without giving numbers, but...
Huge.
I mean, are you kind of proactively retiring hosts simply because they're not worth it from a power factor?
Yes.
Yeah. So you can actually do a pretty good cost-benefit analysis. You know how much it costs to run your machines and how much, for example, money you generate with, you know, say you have, like, you know, these 10 machines. You know how much money they're generating, or you can approximate that number. Let's say you have 10 faster machines. They use a little bit more power, but they give you twice the performance, and you can generate... Let's say, for argument's sake, you can generate twice the amount of money, but they cost more to buy. So you can actually plot that, like how much money will these generate, and how much will it cost, and when, where's the intersection? At what point is it more beneficial to have these new machines compared to these old machines? And that's it actually turns out while the math is hard, actually once you've done it, it's actually not that difficult to start predicting. At what point it's better to...
Yeah, we finally just got rid of Pentium 3s.
Is it something where the business case is easy to make further up into management?
Yes.
Okay. Very absolutely.
Easy. Yeah. Managers like graphs and pretty things. So, having those, I have to say it, Excel is actually really good at making pretty graphs that prove business cases.
Shouldn't you be using Google's graphing in the spreadsheet?
We do.
Yes.
I meant Google spreadsheets. Actually, I don't know. Do we have graphing abilities in Google spreadsheets yet?
I don't think so. That'd be cool if we did.
Can you guys talk a little bit about unit test development? I mean, did you have anything when you started out? Or
we had absolutely no unit tests when we started out. In fact, when I wrote QA Master in Perl, one of the software engineers on the production side said, if I wrote a unit testing framework for Perl, that I'd be a hero. That is completely different today. All the engineers write more unit tests than actual code. And?
Well, there's actually a large push these days to have a larger test coverage in our software. Throughout the whole group, I think we're trying to hit 90% on different baselines, just because we've had problems in the past of not having good coverage and breaking things, that could have been easily, avoided. So it's becoming a really, really big push for us.
Yeah.
Well, since I'm still here and I have another question, how do you guys manage schema changes? If you wanted to make a major change to your schema, how do you keep that going while still supporting your legacy apps as you're rolling things forward?
Sorry.
It's a schema change.
Yeah. that's actually not too difficult because you can do a schema change, name the tables slightly different than they would be in release, and then you can have two things running side by side. So instead of having auto installer status, have auto installer status dev or something like that.
And you don't worry about data consistency between the tables?
If something is really in beta, it's usually not an issue. And it's going to be running in a canary in such a small amount that you can easily keep track of it manually.
Yeah. Well, you were saying that you were running AI1 and AI2 simultaneously.
Right.
And I would imagine that their data sets would intersect.
But the really good thing here is that AI1 had its own one table MySQL database, and AI2 was part of the larger, we call it the MDB machine database, was fully integrated into the MDB. So when it came to machine state, that worked fine, and we were actually able to hand machines off back and forth between the processes. And both of those systems used the same schema and the same way of dealing with machines within the MDB itself. So state information for repairs only was not a problem, because everything was all tied down to the same data set, which is the case opened against a machine.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. In small companies, typically they develop to do the QA by themselves, but in big companies, it's typically have a separate QA team. I'm wondering what's the rate between the number of developers to the number of QAs in Google? What's the perfect rate you think it's one QA to one developer or in another word, more QA is better or more developer is better ideally?
Yeah, we're actually doing less QA now. We used to QA, the mission of QA used to be to release the best machines possible to the production fleet. We do all of our own QAing in-house. We build our own machines. So we get them from our manufacturers, put them in the data center, and put them through a rigorous QA process. After looking at the process as a whole, we realized that, well, why don't we do QA a lot quicker? And if the machines break, they'll just go right into repairs and get fixed probably faster than during the QA process. Does that answer your question?
Kind of. So my question is, what's the rate between the number of developers in Google to the number of QAs?
In all of Google?
Yeah, or in your department, what's the ideal rate you think between the number of developers and the number of QA?
I don't think we know the number of actual QA versus developers in all of Google. But in our group, I think it's
there's a lot less QA people.
There's very few QA people at this point in our group.
Yeah.
Relatively speaking, it's almost completely developers. And to some degree, the developers do some QA work as well. And we work with them together. The sysadmins and the developers, where there isn't a specific QA person working on that.
Yeah, we also do a lot of work. I started off in the data center. These guys started off in the data center. He came on as a sysadmin, so he doesn't know what's going on at all. But because we have ties to the data center and we travel, I've got my guys everywhere. And if something's going to change and something needs some QA and something needs some testing, it's literally sending someone an IM saying, "Hey, you got 5 minutes? Check this out for me." So we do a lot of ad hoc QAing. We don't have an official QA group within our team. Maybe as we get bigger, we could, but right now, the way that we do things is actually working pretty well. And it also it's really good, I'm a big fan of trying to get data center techs up out of the data center and give them more interesting things to do than swap hard drives all day. So when you have 300 people doing that and you say, "Hey, who wants to help me test this, beta this, write code," we tend to get a lot of volunteers. Anybody else?
Cool.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thanks.
And women.